When Kimbrough finally cooled Rusk down, they sought some other oilfield men with the proposition, "Let's waylay their bus before it gets out of town and give that coach a thrashing." And they went in search of it. But the Jacksboro team, fearing just such action, had scuttled out before sunset. In the angered days that followed, Rusk gave orders that no employee of his should ever purchase anything, no matter how small, from any outfit in Jacksboro. And when he was forced to go there on business, he spat on the sidewalks when no one was looking. Of course, when Wichita Falls came down and administered a 31-7 drubbing, he gave the same orders about that infamous town, charging it with having brought in ringers who had never set foot in a Wichita Falls classroom, and Kimbrough joined him in condemnation. In their newfound hatred for Jacksboro and Wichita Falls, the two former adversaries buried their suspicions of each other. It was Dewey who had the bright idea. "Floyd, if Wichita Falls hires outsiders, why can't we?" Assembling the Larkin millionaires, they proposed that "we do something to restore the honor of this town." And Rusk threw himself into this project with all the energy he had once given to the Ku Klux Klan. He and his men gave the coach, a mild-mannered fellow, $100 a month in cash to spend as he deemed best. Rusk himself built a dressing room at the edge of the field so that, as he was fond of saying, Larkin can go first class. The oil men scouted the region for big, tough boys and moved their families into Larkin so that the lads could play on the local team. And when the next autumn came around, it was obvious that Larkin High had a fighting chance to become a football power. One morning, when Rusk delivered his mother's royalty check to her, more money than she and Earnshaw had spent in a dozen years, he found her playing with his son Ransom, a big-boned child, and he cried impulsively, "Damn, I wish he was old enough to play for Larkin." Catching the boy and throwing him high in the air, he caught him and started running through the room like a halfback. Dropping the child back in his crib, he shook his finger at him. "Son, you're going to see real greatness in this town, and maybe you'll even be on the team yourself someday." He then turned his attention to the serious problem of finding an appropriate name for what he now called My Team, and he found that the desirable names had been preempted: Lions, Tigers, Bears, Bearcats, Panthers, Pirates, Rebels, Gunslingers, Hawks. Any animal whose behavior was terrifying had been used. Any role requiring violent or even murderous deportment had been adopted by some small school in the area. One town, famous for its hunting, called its team the Turkeys, an unfortunate name, but Larkin did little better. By a process of painful elimination, it came up with the name of a beast once common in these parts, the antelope. And when this was reluctantly adopted, a more difficult problem arose, because every Texas team had to be the fighting this or that, the fighting tigers, the fighting buffalo, the fighting wildcats. So it had to be the fighting antelopes, even though, as Rusk said, "there's no man in Texas ever saw an antelope fight anything." Under their new leadership, and with a level of support from the oil men that they had never known before, Larkin's fighting antelopes had an autumn of glory up to a point. The team played 9 regular games and won them all. As Rusk boasted at the morning breakfasts in the cafe, "We really crucified Jacksboro, 37-6. They manhandled Breckenridge, too, 41-3. And they even took much bigger Wichita Falls to the cleaners, 24-7. When they won the regional championship in a tight game against Abilene, 9-7, it became clear to Rusk and his associates that our team can go all the way, and the heady prospect of a state championship began to be discussed seriously. "By God, if we can win our next game," Rusk bellowed in the cafe, "we'll get a crack at Waco." But his enthusiasm for such a game distressed the coach of the Fighting Antelopes, for he knew the facts, which he tried to explain to Rusk and Kimbrough. "We've played some good teams, yes, but Waco, they're much different." "Are you chicken?" Rusk demanded, and the coach surprised him by saying, "Yes, our little team would have no chance against Waco." "You ought to be fired," Rusk bellowed. "What kind of talk is this, welching on your own team?" "Mr. Rusk, Waco is coached by Paul Tyson. Does that mean anything?" "He puts his pants on one leg at a time, don't he?" "Yes, but when he gets them on, he's something special." Almost in awe, the coach recited the fearsome accomplishments of that Waco powerhouse. One year, the Waco Tigers scored a total of 784 points. Opponents had 33. "Who did they play?" Rusk asked. "The Sisters of Mercy?" "The best. Of course, there was one game with the Corsicana Orphans Home, 119-0. "Did the orphans have 11 men?" "Only 13. But they were a real team." "No real team loses by 100 points. "Against Waco they do," the worried coach said, and he continued. "They brought down a team from Cleveland, Ohio. National championship. Waco, 44. Cleveland, 12. And in their best year, Waco, 567, opponents, 0. With no opposing team ever moving the ball inside the Waco 35-yard line. And you ask me if I'm scared." But Rusk and his optimistic oil men were not, and when the Fighting Antelopes won their 13th straight game, for high schools played barbarous schedules, the big showdown with Waco for the state championship became inevitable. Most of Larkin, and all of Waco, found ways to get to Panther Park in Fort Worth that memorable Saturday afternoon. For a mere high school game, more than 20,000 showed up. The newspapers had skillfully promulgated the myth that in this age of miracles, antelopes had an outside chance of defeating tigers. It was a day Floyd Rusk would never forget. It eclipsed in significance even that wonderful morning when Rusk No. 3 came in with his verification of the Larkin Field, because this game would be remembered as one of the extraordinary events in the annals of Texas sporting history, but not in a way that Rusk would have wished. Waco Tigers, 83. Larkin Antelopes, nothing. Before the excursion train left Fort Worth, copies of a Dallas newspaper with mocking headlines were available. It really was tigers eating antelopes. And during the train ride home, Rusk took an oath. Brandishing the offensive paper in the faces of his friends, he swore, "This will never happen again. If we have to chew mountains into sand, it will never happen again." Assembling any oilmen who had gone to the game, he extracted promises that Larkin would regain its honor regardless of cost, and Dewey Kimbrough supported him. "Whatever you need, Floyd, the dignity of our town must be restored." Prowling the train to locate the unfortunate coach whose prophecy of Waco invincibility had proved correct, the fat man snarled, "You're fired. No team of mine loses by more than 80 points. Tomorrow we start searching for a real coach." Revenge for the dreadful humiliation in Panther Park became Rusk's obsession, and as he roamed the state looking for what he called my kind of coach, he kept hearing of a man in a small school near Austin, and men who knew football assured him, "This here Cotton Hamey, he's a no-nonsense coach, knocks a kid on his ass if he don't perform." So Rusk telegraphed three of his oilmen to come down from Larkin to look the young genius over. As soon as the committee met Hamey, they knew they had their man. He had gone to A&M to learn animal husbandry, but had been so good at football that he switched to coaching, with the not unreasonable hope that one day he might return to his alma mater in some capacity or other, line coach perhaps, or even head coach, for he had the intelligence to handle either job. They met a man who stood only 5'8", but who was still a crop-headed bundle of muscle and aggression. In college, he had been such a relentless opponent that sports writers had started a legend which still clung to him. At the training table, they feed him only raw meat, 2 pounds with lots of gristle at each sitting. Nicknamed Tiger, he told one sports writer, "I like to play in the other team's backfield." And this imaginative reporter produced a great line. Tiger Haney invades the opposition backfield, grabs three running backs, and sorts them out till he finds who has the ball. The oil men got right down to cases. "Did you see the state championship?" And Haney said, "That's my job." And Rusk asked, "What did you think?" And Haney said, "Your team had no right being on that field." "If you had unlimited power, and I mean unlimited, could you build us a championship team for next December?" Haney rose and walked about the meeting room, flexing his muscles. He was an attractive young man, quick in his movements, intelligent in his responses to questions, and compact, both physically and mentally. He wasted little time on non-essentials. "I can get you into the playoffs, and Waco is losing many of its best players, but I don't think I could beat Paul Tyson next year." "Could you beat him year after next?" Rusk asked. And Haney said, "You get me the horses, I'll get you the championship." "You're hired," Rusk said. He had no authority to hire or fire anyone, for that was the prerogative of the school board. But when a Texas town set his heart on a state football championship, everything else had to give. And when the oil men returned to Larkin, the board quickly confirmed the appointment of Cotton Haney as teacher of Texas history. On the side, he would also do some coaching. Now it became the responsibility of the wealthy oil men to provide the horses. And as soon as Haney was relieved of his duties at the small school near Austin, he moved to Larkin. On his first day in town, he gave Rusk a list of 9 boys living in various parts of Texas whom he would like to see in Antelope's uniforms when the season opened in September. When Rusk visited these boys, he found they all had certain characteristics. They seem to have no neck. Their legs aren't all that big, but their shoulders carved in granite, and they all look about 22 years old. Rusk said on one return to Larkin, "Coach Haney, I don't think any of those boys can run." And Haney explained a fact of life. "To produce a really good team, you have to have linemen. That's where the battles are determined, in the trenches." "But you will get some runners." "I have a second list, almost as important." And when the oil men went to scout these boys, they found quite a different set of characteristics. None of them much over 160, but they are quick, and only half of them seem to be in their 20s. When they reported back to Haney, Rusk asked, "Aren't some of these boys a trifle old?" And he said, "You move them in here. I'll worry about their ages." So now the oil men began prowling the country, visiting with the parents of these young fellows, and offering the fathers good jobs in the oil field, the mothers employment in the local hospital or in stores. One widowed mother said she gave piano lessons, and Rusk said, "You get 2 pianos, one for you, one for your students." In some 20 visits, the question of grades was never raised, for it was supposed that if a boy was good enough to play for Cotton Haney, some way would be found to keep him eligible. And as July came, Rusk could boast, "Not one player on that pitiful team last year will even make the squad this time." He was wrong. Part of the greatness of Haney as a coach was that he could take whatever material was available and forge it into something good. So he found a place for more than a dozen of last year's Antelopes. But he also knew that if he wanted a championship team, he had better have an equal number of real horses. And when August practice started, he had them, brawny young men from various parts of Texas, practiced hands of 20 and 21 who had already played full terms at other schools, and 2 massive linemen who must have been at least 22 with college experience. In this frontier period, the rules governing eligibility in Texas high school football were somewhat flexible. On the eve of the first game, Coach Haney convened a meeting of his backers. "We have a unique problem. We must not win any of these early games by too big a score. I don't want to alert teams like Abilene or Amarillo. And I certainly don't want to let Waco know we're gunning for them." "What are we going to do?" Rusk asked. "Fumble a lot. When we get the ball, We'll run 3-4 powerhouse plays to see what our men can do. He never used the word boys. And when we're satisfied that we can run the ball pretty much as we wish, we'll fumble and start over. I don't want any Waco-type scores, 83-0. I want to win, Rusk said. And Amy snapped, so do I, but in an orderly way. When we go into Fort Worth this year to face Waco, I want them to spend the entire first half catching their breath and asking, what hit us? So in the first 7 games against the smaller teams of the area, Coach Hamey kept his fighting antelopes under wraps. 19-6 was a typical score. But as the Jacksboro game approached, at Jacksboro, Rusk begged for his team to be unshackled. Erase them. Leave grease spots on the field. I believe we could hammer them something like 70-7, and I'd like to see it. Hamey would not permit this, and the game ended 21-7. Enough to keep the record unblemished, but not enough to alert the public that Cotton Hamey had a powerhouse. However, in the Wichita Falls game, everything clicked magically, and at the end of 9 minutes the Antelopes led 27-0, and the first team was yanked. It could have been 107-0, Rusk said. The Antelopes won their division undefeated, and then swept the regionals, which placed them once more in the big finals against the Supermen from Waco. The big newspapers ridiculed the matchup, pointing out that something was wrong with a system which allowed, in 2 successive years, a team as poorly qualified as Larkin to reach the finals against a super team like Waco. And all papers had long articles about the disaster of the previous year, with speculation as to whether or not the Antelopes could keep Waco from once again scoring over 80. There were a few cautions. We must remember that Cotton Hamey does not bring any team into a stadium expecting to lose. This game is not going to be any 83-0 runaway. I predict Waco by 40. Because the Larkin Antelopes appeared to be so weak, the crowd in Fort Worth was not so large as the previous year. But those who stayed home missed one of the epic games of Texas football. Because when Waco received the opening kickoff and started confidently down the field, they were suddenly struck by a front line which tore their orderly plays apart. And before the startled champions could punt, a huge antelope with no neck had tackled a running back so hard that he fumbled. Larkin recovered, and in 4 plays had its first touchdown. On the next kickoff, almost the same thing happened. Larkin linemen simply devoured the Waco backfield. Again there was a fumble on 3rd down, and once more the rampaging Antelopes carried the ball into the end zone. Larkin 13, Waco nothing. But Paul Tyson, considered by many to be the best high school coach ever, was not one to accept such a verdict. And before the next kickoff, he made several adjustments. The principal one being that against that awesome Antelope line, his men would pass more, depending upon the speed of their backs, to outwit the slower Larkin men. Now the game developed into a mighty test of contrasting skills, and for the remainder of this half, the Waco men predominated, so that when the whistle blew to end the 2nd quarter, the score was Larkin 13, Waco 7. But the power of the new Larkin team was obvious to everyone in the stands, and people who had tired of Waco's domination during the Tyson years began to cheer in the 3rd period for the Antelopes to score again, and this they did. Larkin 19, Waco 7. That was the last of the Antelope scoring, for now the superb coaching of the Waco Tigers began to tell. Pound at the line and get nowhere, a quick pass for 19 yards, deceptive handoff, a deft run for 17 yards. 3 times in that 3rd quarter, the Tigers approached the Larkin goal line, and 3 times the Fighting Antelopes turned the back in last-inch stands. But at the start of the 4th quarter, the Waco quarterback pulled a daring play. Faking passes to his ends and handoffs to his running backs, he spun around twice and literally walked into the end zone. Larkin 19, Waco 13. The 4th quarter would often be referred to as the greatest last quarter in high school history, because the Waco team, smelling a chance for victory, came down the field four glorious times, bedazzling the antelopes with fancy running and lightning passes. But always, near the goal, the antelope line would stiffen and the drive fail. After a few futile rushes, the Larkin kicker would send long punts zooming down the field, and the inexorable Waco drive would restart. Four times Coach Tyson's men came close to scoring. Four times they were denied. And from the stands a leather-lunged spectator cried, "They sure are fightin' antelopes." But on the fifth try, with only minutes on the clock, the Waco team could not be stopped, and the score became Larkin 19, Waco 19. Then one of those beautiful, tragic episodes unfolded which make football such a marvelous sport, beautiful to the victors, tragic to the losers. With little more than a minute to play, Waco fielded a punt deep in its own territory, and instead of playing out the clock, unleashed three swift plays that carried the ball to the Larkin 11. Timeout was called with only seconds left, and Waco prepared for a field goal attempt. "Dear God, let it fail," Rusk prayed, and he could see around him other oilmen voicing the same supplication. "Just this once, God, let it fail." The stadium was hushed, the teams lined up. The ball was snapped, the kicker dropped the ball perfectly, swung his foot, and sent the pigskin on its way. With never a waver, the ball sped through the middle of the uprights. Waco 22, Larkin 19. On the train trip home, Floyd Rusk surprised himself, for he could feel no bitterness over the loss. Passing back and forth through the train, he embraced everyone, spectators, team members, his fellow oilmen, and to all he said, "This is the proudest day in my life." Then he would begin to blubber. Who said our antelopes couldn't fight? But when he reached Coach Hamey, who also had tears in his eyes, he said, "I want the names of 15 more men we could use next autumn. I want to crush Waco. I want to tear 'em apart, shred by shred." "So do I," Hamey said grimly. And within a week of their return home, he had given Rusk 18 names of high school players whose presence in Larkin would reinforce the already good team. Before the 1st of January, Rusk and his oilmen had more than a dozen of these fellows transferred into the Larkin district, where their parents were given jobs in the local businesses. Score that following year, Larkin 26, Waco 6. These were the years when the Fighting Antelopes met in Homeric struggle with teams from much larger towns like Abilene, Amarillo, Lubbock, and Fort Worth. With one winning streak of 31 regular games and two additional state championships, the team attracted national attention. And when a Chicago sports writer asked Cotton how he accounted for that record, the coach replied, "Two things, attention to detail and character building." While Floyd Rusk was enjoying his victories with the imaginary antelopes, and they were his victories because he had purchased most of the players, his mother was having her own victories with her real longhorns. In 1927, the federal government became aware that on its western plains, the longhorn breed was about to become extinct, like the passenger pigeon and the buffalo. When agitation by lovers of nature awakened national attention, a bill sponsored by Wyoming Senator John B. Kendrick was passed, allocating $3,000 to be used in an attempt to save the breed. A large buffalo refuge in the Wichita Mountains of Oklahoma, not far from the Texas border, was set aside for such pure stock as could be found. But then it was discovered that in all the United States there seemed to be less than 36 verified longhorn cows and no good bull. Even when these were located, most were found to be of a degenerative quality, untended for generations, and bred only by chance. Loss of horn was especially noted, for the famous rocking chairs were being produced no more. Often the federal research team would hear of them real longhorns down to the Tucker place, only to find 6 miserable beasts not qualified to serve as breeding stock. Better luck was found in the rural ranches of Old Mexico, where unspoiled cattle that retained the characteristics of the Texas Longhorn could occasionally be found. Some ranchers objected to basing the revived strain of what was essentially a Texas breed on imports from Mexico, but the U.S. experts stifled that complaint with two sharp observations. Mexico is where they came from in the first place, and when you Texas people did have them, you didn't take care of them. So the famous Texas cattle were saved in Oklahoma by a senator from Wyoming importing cattle from Mexico. However, late in their search, the federal men heard of a magical enclave near the town of Larkin, Texas, where a feisty old woman with no nose had been rearing longhorns for as long as anyone could remember. In great excitement, they hurried down from the Wichita refuge to see what Emma Larkin had stashed away in her own little refuge. And when they first saw Mean Moses VI grazing peacefully among his cows, his horns big and heavy and with never a twist, they actually shouted with joy, "We've found a real longhorn!" And what made this bull additionally attractive were the cows and steers sired by him, their horns showing the Texas twist, some to such an exaggerated degree that they were museum pieces. "Can we buy your entire herd?" the federal men asked 10 minutes after they saw Emma Rusk's longhorns. "You cannot," she snapped. "Can we have that great bull you call Mean Moses VI? "Not if you came at me with guns." "What can we have for a national project to save the breed?" When she sat with them and heard the admirable thing they were trying to do, and when she saw the photographs of the terrain at the wildlife refuge, she became interested. But when they showed her the scrawny animals they had been able to collect so far, she became disgusted. "You can't restore a breed with that stock." "We know," the men said, allowing the logical conclusion to formulate in her mind. She said nothing, just sat rocking back and forth, a little old woman whose mind was filled with visions of the vast plains she had loved. She saw her father and his brothers probing into the Larkin area and deciding to establish their homestead on the Brazos. She saw scenes from her life with the Comanche, when she and they galloped over terrain from Kansas to Chihuahua. But most of all, she saw R.J. Poteet droving his immense herds of longhorns to market at Dodge City. And from that herd of swirling animals emerged the creatures she had identified as worth saving. Lovingly, she recalled the morning when Earnshaw cried, "Thy bull has gored my bull." And then she visualized that first Mean Moses striding through strands of barbed wire. The wire had kept him away from the hay when he wasn't really hungry, but when he knew his cows needed him, he had pushed it aside as if it were cobwebs on a frosty morning. She knew what she must do. "I'll let you have Mean Moses VI, and any 4 of his bull calves you prefer. But of greater importance, I suspect, will be the cows in direct line from Bathtub Bertha. I've always thought that the tremendous horns we find in our longhorns can be traced to Bathtub. Have you ever seen a photograph of her?" From her mementos, she produced 2 photographs of the extraordinary cow. And when the visitors saw those incredible horns, the tips almost touching before the cow's eyes, they realized that they had found something spectacular, something Texan. At Wichita, the Larkin strain would become known as MM/BB, and wherever in the United States men attentive to history sought to reinstitute the longhorn breed, they would start first with a good MM/BB bull from the Wichita surplus and a score of cows descended from Bathtub. Emma was not content to have the federal people load her animals into trucks and haul them into Oklahoma. She wanted to deliver them personally. And when she saw Moses fight his way down the ramp and make a series of lunges at everything around him, she felt assured that in the dozen good years he still had ahead of him, he would get his line firmly established. as she watched her animals disperse into the grasslands of their new home. One of the federal men asked, "Are you sorry to lose your great bull?" And she snapped, "What you didn't see at Larkin was his son, the one I hid aside to be Mean Moses the Seventh. That one's going to be twice the bull his father was." She was not allowed to see this prediction come true, for on the trip home she began to feel a heavy constriction across her chest. "Would you drive a little faster?" she asked, and each time the pain became greater, she called for greater speed. The car was now near the Texas border. Ahead lay the Red River, that shallow, wandering stream which had always protected Texas on the north, and she was eager to cross it. "Could you please drive a little faster?" she pleaded in her customary whisper. And only later did the occupants of the car realize that she had been determined to get back to Texas before she died. Task Force. Because our members were always striving to identify which special agencies produced the uniqueness of Texas, we invited the Dean of Writers on High School Football to address us at our October meeting in Waco, and although he said he had no time to prepare a formal paper since this was the height of the football season, he would be honored to join us on any Monday or Tuesday when the high schools were not holding important practices. We informed him that we would adjust our schedule to his, and that he had things backward. We were the ones who would be honored. He was Pepper Hatfield of the Larkin Defender, and when Miss Cobb and I met him at the airport, we saw a man of 73 who retained the same lively joy in things he'd had at 40. "They gave me the best job in the world. Still love it. Still amazed by what young boys can accomplish." His eyes sparkled. His marine haircut was a clean iron gray, and his voice had a lively crackle. He launched our three-hour discussion on a high philosophical note. "The essential character of Texas, at least in this century, has been formed by three experiences. But before I say what they are, let me remind you of this essential truth about things Texan. The significant ones have never been determined by the big cities. Houston, Dallas, San Antone, they've never defined what a Texan is. That insight comes only from the small towns. Always has, and I'm convinced always will. The good old boy with his pickup, his six-pack, and his rifle slung in the rack behind his head. He's a small-town creation. Limited to places of under 8,000, I'd say." Miss Cobb would not accept this. "Do you mean to say the pickup and the six-pack define Texans?" "I do not. What I intended to point out was that even these modern characteristics are predominantly small-town." "What are the essentials?" she asked. "I was about to say," Hatfield said, with just the slightest irritation at having been interrupted on the subject of football by a woman, "that my significant characteristics derived from the small town, and I think you'll agree that they account for most of the Texas legend as it exists today. The ranch, the oil well, Friday night football." Now, it's curious, and I think particularly Texan, that books and plays and movies and television shows galore have idealized the first two. How many cowboy films have we had? How many television shows about Texas oil people? You ever see that great Clark Gable, Spencer Tracy, Claudette Colbert picture, Boomtown? Or the best Texas picture made so far, Red River? Or the second best, Giant? All oil and ranching, and I could name a dozen other goodies. That's because outsiders made the pictures. That's because outsiders were defining how we should look at ourselves. But there's never been a really first-rate book or play or dramatic presentation of Friday night football. And why not? Because people outside of Texas don't appreciate the total grandeur of that tradition. I never met a single stranger to Texas who had any appreciation of what high school football means to a Texan. Closest were those clowns in the Pennsylvania coal regions. They started boasting that they were the hotbed of high school football. And I do admit they sent a lot of their graduates to colleges all over America, like Joe Namath to Alabama. but I started a movement to send an all-Texas high school team north to play the all-Pennsylvanians. You know what happened. A slaughter. Texas won every game. He rattled off the scores as if the games had occurred yesterday. 26-10, 34-2, 45-14. And he could do this with all the statistics of his chosen field. He needed no notes. So after we'd clobbered Pennsylvania three times, they called off the game. Too humiliating. And if we'd played any other state on the same basis, our scores would have been higher. Texas high school football is unbelievable. We have about 1,000 schools playing each weekend, 500 fascinating games. In a year, maybe 500,000 spectators will see the 8 Dallas Cowboys home games. 8 million will see their favorite high school teams. He now dropped his voice to that whispered serio-tragic level which clergymen use when conducting funeral services for people they had never known while living. As you know, an all-Oklahoma high school team beat an all-Texas the last 2 years. We didn't send our best players, but you just can't explain it. And he sighed. But let's get back to fundamentals of the Texas character. The ranch gives us the cowboy, and now that there are hardly any of them left, what's more important, the cowboy clothes. You ever see that great picture of Bum Phillips walking across the football field in his Stetson hat and his General Quimper boots? That's Texas. Or the Marlboro man herding his steers in a panhandle blizzard? That's Texas. I thought the Marlboro man was from Wyoming, Garza said, and Pepper dismissed him. They shoot all the photos out on the 6666 ranch in Guthrie, King County. Keep the Marlboro store right on the ranch. And the same goes for the oil man. He may no longer be the dominant economic factor, what with OPEC misbehavior and the rise of Silicon Valley over in Dallas. But emotionally, he is still emperor of the Texas Plains. Best thing ever happened to oil. It moved from being a monopoly of East Texas out to Central Texas, where I grew up, and then on to the Permian Basin, real out west. Make it universal Texan, the way cattle never were, and gave us some powerful imagery, not only in the production of the oil well itself, that wonderful gusher blackening the sky, but in the oil man, too. Best cartoon on Texas I ever saw showed a typical West Texas wildcatter living in this shack with his bedraggled wife. Behind them, you see a gusher coming in on their pasture, and the old woman is yelling to her husband, "Call Neiman Marcus and see how late they stay open on Thursdays." "You seem to incline always toward the cheapest view of our state, Mr. Hatfield," Miss Cobb protested. And Pepper replied with never a pause, "I don't do the choosing, ma'am. The people do. And one of the best things I ever heard about any state came from Hawaii. Group of local politicians there, about 1960, awoke to the fact that their new state was no longer a bunch of hooly-hooly girls waving their hips. It was a modern state, with a sugar industry and pineapple and a good university. So they started advertising such things in mainland magazines, and tourism dropped 40%. Right quick, they went back to the hooly-hoolies, and there they stay, with tourism way up. Texas, ma'am, is ranches and oil and Friday night football, and you people in command better not try to sell anything else." Pepper was at his best when reminiscing about the great high school teams and players he had known. "I started as a boy, watching Coach Cotton Hamey's immortal teams at Larkin. They won 3 state championships. As some of you may remember, I got my big break as a sports writer by a romantic piece I submitted to a Dallas newspaper about the 5 awesome linemen Coach Hamey brought with him to Larkin. I called them the 5 Oil Derricks, and the name caught on." He smiled, recalling that lucky shot. 3 papers spoke to me about jobs, so I prepared a second article about my 5 Derricks because they awed me. They all seemed older than my pop, because eligibility rules were a little looser then. Well, my second article proved that when those 5 men enrolled as freshmen at Larkin, they'd already played a total of 23 years in high school or beyond. Do you know what that means? 4 years of high school in some place far distant for each man, with three of them having 1 year beyond that. The oldest man was married, had two children, and had played for an Oklahoma college. Now he had 4 more years with us, 10 years in all, and still in high school. "I never read that story," Rusk said, "and as you know, my father was crazy about Larkin football." "There was good reason you didn't read it. Someone warned your father about my story before I finished it, and he came to me one night. 'Son, you're not going to print that pack of lies, are you?' I showed him my documentation, and he brushed it aside. 'Son, would you pee on your mother's grave? To be foul Texas football is the same thing.' He grabbed my story and tore it up, my notes too. And next day, the editor of the Larkin Defender called and said, 'Mr. Rusk has recommended you highly for a job on our paper. I've never left.'" He smiled at Ransom Rusk, then said, "Other sports writers didn't have the same high regard for the welfare of the game. During the year of our second championship, maybe the best high school team Texas ever produced, a cynical writer on a Dallas newspaper did a famous column in which he wrote, 'My all-Texas high school team for this year is the Larkin Fighting Antelopes, because each player on that team comes from a different town in Texas and is the state's best in his position.' I never stooped to cheap shots like that." But certain fundamental facts must be remembered if you're searching for the true Texas character. The population of Larkin, in those days after the oil boom had retreated to its natural level, leaving just a little boost, 3,600. But when the Antelopes played at home in the golden years, 4,200 attended each game, and when they played at some nearby bitter rival like Ranger, Cisco, Breckenridge, or Jacksboro, 1,900 of our 3,600 would travel to the other town. It was mass mania. Nothing in life was bigger than Friday football, and when lights made it possible to play at night, even more people could attend, and the field became a kind of cathedral under the stars. Now it was Friday night football, as grand an invention as man has made, with the entire community meeting for spiritual warmth. A storekeeper who wasn't 100% behind the team, his business would go bust. A bank would have to close shop if its manager wasn't at every game and putting up money on the side to pay for uniforms and paying for training tables and other goodies. Every man in town had to root for the Antelopes, or else. And that still applies throughout this state. "It sounds to me," said Miss Cobb, "like the birth of the macho image. A lot of grown men playing like boys, and no women allowed." "Ah, now there's where you make your great mistake, ma'am. Because the genius of Texas football was that early on, it realized it must also involve the girls. So in Larkin, we started the cheerleader tradition, and the drill team, and the rifle exhibition, and the baton twirlers, and the marchers in their fluffy uniforms. On a good Friday night now, a big high school may have 200 boys doing something, what with the squad and the band, but it'll have 300 pretty girls in one guise or another. So girls play almost as important a role as the boys. Otherwise, the spectacle might have lost its grip on the public." Like all Texas football coaches and sports writers, Pepper aspired to be the perfect gentleman, and now he smiled at Miss Cobb. "You were right on one thing, though, ma'am. Football does carry a strong macho image. One of the reasons why Texans distrust Mexicans, or even despise them at times, they can't play football. Quite pitiful, really. Put them on a horse, they can swagger. But the one game that matters, they can't play." "Aren't you stressing the values rather strongly, Mr. Hatfield?" "Not at all. Texans identify honest values quickly. They can't be fooled, not for long. That's why 78% of our high school administrators are ex-football coaches." "That may account for the sad condition of Texas education," Miss Cobb said. "Wait a minute. Back up. School boards hire football coaches to be their administrators because they know that anyone connected with football has his head screwed on right. He understands the important priorities, and he isn't going to be befuddled by poetry and algebra and all that. He knows that if he can get his students involved in a good football program, girls and boys alike, the other things will take care of themselves. Miss Cobb had a penetrating question. I read that last year Texas colleges graduated 500 football coaches and only 2 people qualified to teach calculus. Is that the balance you recommend? For many Texas boys, high school football will be the biggest, noblest thing they'll ever experience. Calculus teachers you can hire from those colleges in Massachusetts. He was especially ingenious in outlining the symbiotic relationship between oil and football. Never underestimate the importance of oil. That's where the extra money came from. Great teams like Breckenridge and Larkin and Ranger were fanatically supported by oil men. Great teams like Breckenridge and Larkin and Ranger were fanatically supported by oil men. Odessa Permian, too, in a way. You see, each stresses the big gamble. If you're in oil, you wildcat and lose everything. If you're that first Larkin team, you go up against Waco and lose 83-0. You don't give a damn. You come back with another try. Oilmen and football heroes were made for each other. But there was another aspect equally strong. An oil millionaire in a place like Larkin had damned little to spend his money on. No opera, no theater, no museums, no interest in books. And when you've had one Cadillac, you've had them all. What was left? The high school football team. You cannot imagine how possessive the oil men of Ranger and Breckenridge and Larkin became over their football teams. Most of them hadn't gone to college, so they didn't become agitated over SMU or A&M. The high school team was all they had, and they supported it. Boy, did they support it. I know high school teams right now that have a head coach and 10 assistants. Yes, a coach for tight ends, 1 for wide ends, 2 coaches for interior linemen, offensive and defensive. Quarterback, running backs, linebacker, defensive backs, a coach for each. Special teams coach, kicking coach. The 4 top Texas high school teams could lick the bottom 50% of college teams up north. The highlight of his comments came toward the end of the afternoon when he said, with his eyes half closed, "I can see them now, those legions of immortal boys who got their lives started on the right track through Friday night football. They were enabled to go on to college, and some to big money in the pros, and there wasn't a hophead or a drunk or a bum among them. Sammy Baugh, Davey O'Brien, Big John Kimbrough, Doak Walker, Don Meredith, Kyle Rote, Earl Campbell. And add the 2 who were famed only in high school. They may have been the best of the bunch. Booty Johnson of Waco and Kenny Hall, the Sugarland Express." His eyes misted over. He was an old man now, but he could recall each critical game he had attended, each golden boy whose exploits he had described, as if they had been fighting not on the football fields of Texas, but at the gates of Troy or on the plains of Megiddo. "Thank you, Mr. Hatfield," Miss Cobb said in closing. "We needed to be reminded of the values you represent. You see, I was sent north to school." "Ma'am, you missed the heart of Texas."